Hi, I'm Richard Karn, and you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable pocket hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting radio-exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free pocket pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size Copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. W-A-T-E-R to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Hose. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethose.com/terms.
Receiving this message.
We are Ken Jennings and John Roderick. We speak to you from our present, which we can only assume is your distant past, the turbulent time that was the early 21st century.
Fearing the great cataclysm that will surely befall our civilization, we began this monumental reference of strange and obscure human knowledge. These recordings represent our attempt to compile and preserve wonders and esoterica that would otherwise be lost.
So whether you're listening from an advanced civilization or have just reinvented the technology to decrypt our transmissions, this is our legacy to you.
This is our time capsule. This is the Omnibus.
You have accessed entry 973.PS10709, certificate number 30037. Poutine.
We asked for back bacon, and the waitress said, like, take off, you hosers. We don't have any of that.
Poutine.
Le poutine.
Last week we did an episode on Canada.
It was kind of about Ireland, but I had a ton of Canada.
It was a lot of Canada talk.
Too much.
And my love of Canada is so strong. I'm not pitting my love of Canada or Australia against your love of Canada or Australia.
Because you would lose.
But I do feel like we don't have enough Canada content.
CanCon.
And, you know, we have more Canada content than Mexico content, the more I think about
Mexcon.
It. MexCon. For a North American-based podcast.
We did that show about how Yugoslavia loves mariachi music.
Yeah, we've done some Mexico shows.
But not
sure.
Enough.
We should focus our attention more on Mexico.
If we were doing this show from Yuma, Arizona,
yeah,
or El Paso, Texas.
We'd be talking about it a lot.
But we're on the Canadian border.
We're really 1.5 hours from Canada here.
Less if you really hoof it.
If you hoof it, right.
If you take a seaplane.
If you take a seaplane, yeah, we'll be there in 20 minutes.
It's nice.
And we're only 1.5 hours because the roads are so bad.
That's right.
And also they stopped, the interstate goes away somewhere outside of Vancouver. It just peters out.
It is kind of weird. Suddenly you just hit a stoplight.
Yeah.
And you're like, Canada?
I thought we were on a big highway. And then it's like, nope, you're on a busy street now.
That's the Canadian way.
It is.
Maybe they didn't plow under all their poor neighborhoods in 1960.
It's not even running through poor neighborhoods. It's like it hits a city street and it's like, these are pretty nice houses along this major thoroughfare.
That's because Vancouver has no nice houses.
Oh, that's nice. What about those Canadian mid-century super boxes that we did a whole episode on?
I don't even remember this. So yes, except for those.
We got a lot of angry letters because I said that they were dumb or like weird, and Canadians were like, they're amazing.
We did a whole show about mid-century Canadian super boxes?
Vancouver architecture fans. Well, as part of our like Googie.
Oh, the Googie show.
I think we talked about Canadian Googies.
I remember this. The worst kind, Canadian Googies.
But I love Canada, yes. As you love Canada.
It's great.
And, you know, we talk about Quebecois, Quebec residents.
That can't be Quebecois.
Quebecois.
Quebecois?
Quebecquires?
I'm not sure what they're... Well, I just say Quebecers.
We rarely talk about Quebec on the show.
Quebecers.
Well, I mean, we talk about Gordon Lightfoot six times an entry, but do we talk about Quebec? Less.
We bounce around Quebec because it's right there in the middle. It's right there in the middle of everything.
I've been to Cirque du Soleil, and that's about it.
Yeah.
I was in Montreal for a couple hours once. So I feel like my sense of French Canadians is that they're always jumping on trampolines and spinning from ribbons on the ceiling.
That's not entirely untrue. That is pretty much what it's like.
My studies of Celine Dion reveal that they have large traditional Catholic families.
There is a lot there's a lot about Quebec that is not like the rest of Canada. And in fact, if you go up, so I've been all over it mm-hmm. for a variety of reasons, chasing a magic rabbit. But if you go into the smaller towns in Quebec, they're really oriented around a kind of, it's not even really a French town plan. They have their own kind of town plan, like it's based around a square. Mm. The town is square-shaped. And there is a...
That's what Napoleon wanted.
That's right. It's their fighting posture, the fighting square. Or actually, that was
not Napoleon.
That was not Napoleon. That was what defeated him. But anyway, you know, there's a big Catholic church. It doesn't feel like other parts of Canada.
Which is good.
Yep. It's unique.
No.
Uniquois.
Yes.
And, right. You know, Quebec City is a fascinating place, a castle, and it's very cute. And, you know, I've often joked that that the people of Quebec do not like Canadians.
That's not a joke.
They don't like Americans, and they don't like the French. They really, the only people they like are, like, from New Orleans, and that's just sort of a, like...
They hear another just, like, terrible, yeah. abhorrent version of French being spoken, and their ears, their little ears perk up.
And the French don't like them, and,
Yes.
You know, it's a very, they have a very interesting relationship with,
But it's a strong and vibrant culture when you think of the music and the film and the, well, and the circus juggling that comes out of there.
Yeah.
Like Montreal's a big arts scene.
The official motto of Quebec is Je me souviens, which means I remember.
What do they remember? Do they have a grudge? Are they nostalgic or are they angry?
It feels pretty grudgy.
I can hear Edith Piaf kind of singing something like that.
Yeah, it's a little bit, yeah.
Like we remember when you didn't want to put French on the traffic signs?
We remember every slight, maybe.
The North remembers.
Yeah, we don't forget our Frenchness, and we will remember that against all comers, including the English Canadians who want to suppress our Quebecness, and the French who deny our Frenchness, and you know it's like
they're a scrappy group.
They're scrappy. Montreal, of course, one of the great cities of the world.
Beautiful,
although all of their malls are weird.
They have malls?
Yeah, they have malls. Weird malls. I found them weird.
They have Hot Topic, Le Topic Show?
I believe they do. You know, one time I left a bag full of money in a Montreal restaurant.
As a sociological experiment.
It was a weird thing, like, let's see what happens. No, I had a bag full of money, like a suitcase full of money, and I was eating in this restaurant. And
waiting for the kidnappers to show up.
I forgot it. Like a stupid, I mean, if you have a bag full of money, what a stupid thing to do. There's a lot of stupid things you could do. You could trade it. For a hostage. I guess that wouldn't be stupid.
Why did you have are you a drug dealer in the story?
No. But you know, when you're a traveling.
Some promoter just gave you cash.
When you're a musician, you don't know what to do with money. And these days, money, you know, moves around electronically. But it used to be that you would get paid at the end of a show, sometimes with like a giant wad of cash.
Like you just have a bag of toonies.
Just a
loonies
just,
and toonies.
Well, no, they're not, they don't pay you in coin.
That would be funnier.
That would be funny. Ben Gibbard of Death Cab told a story one time where he went into a bank in Sacramento with this giant stack of money, and he was depositing it, And there was some young teller who, as he was counting the money, dropped a stack of money on the floor and pretended he hadn't. And Ben said, "I think you dropped some money." And he said, "Huh? What?" "Oh," and gave him like a look and then was like, "Yes, I guess I did." And what it was because of Sacramento culture, this teller was skimming because he thought it was drug money.
Oh, he thought,
here comes this young guy with,
and he thinks nobody will complain.
Yeah. Here comes this young guy with 30 grand in cash. And he's like, "Well, I'm going to drop $1,000 on the floor."
I'm learning so much about Sacramento culture.
Yeah. And Ben was like,
what element, by the way, of Sacramento culture accords with
drugs? You know, like if you go outside of Sacramento up to Grass Valley or all that country out there, it's all full of weed dealers, or it used to be. Not weed dealers, weed growers. I used to know the mayor of Grass Valley, California. And he was, I'm not outing him because this was more than 30 years ago. He was the biggest stoner I ever met. Great guy.
It's called Grass Valley.
Grass Valley.
The mayor has to be a stoner.
It's quite beautiful. You know, it's just down from Donner Pass.
Ah.
So it just goes to show that there's no connection between anything.
I'm learning so much about Sacramento culture.
So anyway, I'm in Montreal and I have a big suitcase full of money. I leave it in the bar and I go all the way across town to go to some discotheque. And it's only as I'm going into the discotheque that I realize there's something missing. It's my suitcase full of money.
Of all the things.
And then it was like the whole path I had taken to get to this disco had involved taxis and all of this other stuff. And I didn't have time for that. And so I ran all the way across Montreal as like a Run Lola Run kind of.
But like, with the cobblestones must hurt.
It would have been a hilarious film. Like, this guy, he's got, and then, you know, hijinks ensued. I went the wrong way, this way, that way, and I'm running through. And it's such a cool town full of people just having the times of their lives. And I got back to the bar or the, you know, the place. And I go, burst in. And everybody in the bar is like, "Ha, ha, ha, we found your suitcase full of money." And I walked over to the, and they had my suitcase full of money. And they had, everybody in the bar knew it was full of money. And they were like, "You dummy, you left your suitcase full of money here."
They're an honest, hardworking people.
That's the point of this story, that everyone in, at least Montreal, has integrity enough to find, because somebody, I'm sure, was like, "Oh, look, that guy left his suitcase full of money. Let's open it and see what if there's ID or something." And then they were like, "It's full of money." And then they showed it to everybody in the bar. Like, "Look at this guy."
Everybody's lit like the Pulp Fiction briefcase.
Because I think they figured he'll be back.
Are you just saying what honest people they are so you can go on to make jokes about them for the next hour and no one will complain?
Well, no. Although jokes about them does figure into the story.
Hmm.
You're a foodie.
Eh,
I think of you as a foodie.
I like trying new kinds of food.
But you and your wife Mindy do keep abreast of the new restaurants in the city, the restaurants that are getting.
I think it takes more than Seattle restaurants to make you a foodie.
Yeah, that's true.
We don't have the greatest food scene.
Well, I mean, we got great food, and if you like salmon and clams,
the pho is pretty amazing. Good. Yes.
There's good food here.
We like, no, there's really.
Well, I guess that's right.
We are under punching our weight in terms of food, but Portland's right there. At least Vancouver's right there.
You're going to say Portland and Vancouver
have much better food scenes, not just per capita, but like even considering the fact that Portland's smaller than us.
Why is that?
I don't know.
It doesn't make sense.
It can't purely be cost of living.
Well, you know what it is? It's everything in Seattle closes at 7:30 p.m. So how do you have a good food scene if it's like there's no after scene?
I'm worried that all the trends that ruin Seattle are just, you know, inevitably Portland's only a few years behind us in every one of those trends.
Yeah.
Is the good food going to go away, is the scene strong enough to survive?
Well, the one trend that Portland is not just a few years behind us is being full of billionaires.
That's true.
Yeah. I don't think Portland is going to become like a super tech hub. I think there are a lot of graphic artists down there, which is not bringing in the cash.
It doesn't matter how many copies of your noir comic book you sell?
I don't think so. I think what they don't have is a lot of like super dorks with propeller hats like we had 30 years ago.
They have tennis shoe designers.
Yeah.
It's better. Exactly.
But you, as a food liker,
uh-huh.
but also as an avowed person who has avoided North Dakota at all costs.
That's how I've lived my life.
Have you ever eaten Midwestern cheese curds?
Oh, yeah.
And now how? What was your exposure to curds?
I feel like there's some Mountain West dairy curd overlap.
It has come out here.
Like,
that's right.
Like I've been, like I've, you know, up here, I'm sure Tillamook has curd culture, but I've been to, when I went to, I was somewhere in Wyoming, like Star Valley, Wyoming,
mm-hmm.
and they love to sell you squeaky cheese.
Yeah.
Which is, they think a fun family friendly thing to call cheese curds. Maybe nobody wants to eat anything with curd in the name.
Well, squeaky is one of them. One of the main identifying characteristics of good curd, good cheese curd.
It is squeaky, but I didn't know they branded it that way.
Mm-hmm.
Like you don't want to eat cheese curd because, you know,
curdle.
Yeah. It sounds like curdle. It sounds like bean curd.
Yeah.
The poor Kurds in Iraq can't catch a break.
Right.
But if you call it squeaky cheese, then the kids are going to be like,
oh,
give me some of that. I don't want regular cheese.
Let's stop and get the cheese that squeaks.
So it's like a souvenir cheese.
Yeah.
And then I think it was Culver's, the Wisconsin burger chain Culver's expanding into the West,
mm-hmm.
where they have deep fried cheese curd as their kind of, it's their French fry, basically.
When you think of cheese curds, do you think of them primarily as a deep fried food or as a fresh cheese product?
I discovered them as a fresh cheese product, and Culver's convinced me, and I was an easy sell, but they're also pretty good deep fried.
Yeah, they're awful good deep fried.
I guess I now that I'm thinking about it, I realize I don't know what it is that, I mean, is a cheese, how is a cheese curd different than a cheese? It's
mm-hmm.
it's obviously a different shape.
Mm-hmm.
Like if you had just put the same gunk in a big barrel, would you get cheddar cheese? And if you don't, somehow you get cheese curd? Is it?
Well,
the texture's a little different,
cheese
right?
Curd is what is the material that is in the process of becoming cheese, but you get in the way of it. You pull it out before it is cheese. What cheese is aged, squashed cheese curd.
Cheesus interruptus.
Uh-huh.
You got to eat it before it cheeses.
Yeah. What cheese is you take milk and you curdle it.
Yeah.
And then you press out the whey, which is the watery part, and the curdle is the curd. The muck is.
That's why I don't understand why the curd is different than just cheese. You've gotten rid of the whey. Curd is the cheese.
The curd is the cheese, but what you do to make cheddar cheese is you take the curd and you throw it all together and you keep pressing it and then you let it sit there.
You gotta age it.
Basically, you curdle it and then you let it rot.
So cheese curd never ages.
Not rot.
So it has a less subtle taste.
Well, so the squeakiness of curd cheese is a sign that it is really, you know, between 12 and 24 hours old.
Oh, it's fresh.
Yeah. And as the cheese even gets more than a day old, the squeakiness starts to depart because the squeakiness is part of like a protein that squeaks against your teeth. And as it ages even a little.
I assume cheese curd was squeaky forever.
No. In fact, if you refrigerate cheese curd, the squeakiness goes away just as a component of the process of refrigerating it.
Oh, wow.
So within the Midwest, upper Midwest and Canada, where cheese curd really became, you know, part of the popular cuisines.
Is it a snack food?
As a snack food. It's kind of a salty, pop it in your mouth, squeaky cheese product.
I mean, if you're a dairy farmer, of course you're going to enjoy that workplace treat.
Yeah.
And if you're living somewhere that's sufficiently dairy suffused, word's going to catch on.
One of the things that curdles a cheese, this is for those of you who are super vegetarian or super pita oriented. you should maybe plug your ears for a second here.
Are cow stomachs about to enter the chat?
Cow stomachs are entering the chat. You know, the protease enzyme that creates the curd is traditionally rennet, which is a product that's in a calf's stomach to process the milk that it gets from its mother.
It just happens to have the enzyme that makes cheese. You can't just put it. You can't just toss it in vinegar or something.
Yeah, wouldn't that be crazy that a calf would have in its stomach the ability
to make its own cheese?
Mm-hmm.
Some cow needs to evolve the ability to just produce cheese. They have the milk. They have the rennet.
Why not poop out cheese?
Exactly.
And so the rennet that is used to process cheese is actually sort of a byproduct of the veal industry.
Oh.
They take the calf stomachs and they process them to create, you know, to like get the rennet out of it.
Adult cows don't have it, huh?
No. So that is that's the part that now if you had your ears plugged and now you're tentatively unplugging them, you can unplug them. And so, you know, rennet has now no longer plays that big of a role in the production of cheese. Now there are there's something called rennin, which is a protease enzyme that doesn't require
a way to produce. But I assume there are still artisanal cheeseries that are like, we make our Colby the old-fashioned way.
100% cow stomach process.
But does that mean cheese is never kosher?
Well, that's the thing. The rennin, which is called chymosin, is because there are lots of ways you can derive chymosin from even from vegetarian sources. And so, yeah, in order to make kosher cheese, you cannot use rennet. And it's part of, but I mean, you've always been able to make cheese without it, but this is the kind of, you know, the story is that some nomad put a bunch of sheep milk in a bag that he'd made out of a calf stomach.
That was amazed.
And then, yeah. Half a day later, he was like, wait a minute. What is all this?
I made fondue.
Look at me. But so, and you know, what's really interesting is that whey, the watery part,
mm-hmm.
after it's squeezed out, it used to be a waste product. And as America got swole and all of these, and we had so many cows mass producing milk and cheese.
And they were just tossing this stuff into the Ohio River?
You're exactly right. It was a waste product. They poured it in the rivers. And that was a big part of why in the mid-century we had all these algae-choked rivers, and the algae was prohibited, you know, it sucked all the oxygen out of the rivers and killed all the other things, fish and whatnot.
No way.
At a certain point, we had to pass legislation that said
no way.
No way in the rivers. And for a while, they didn't know what to do with all this whey. And so they started using it as filler in like ice cream and other products. Like, we're just going to put a bunch of whey in here.
They had to start tricking weightlifters. The hardest group of people to trick.
And then it became a health additive. And now there's a huge whey industry.
There's a whey shortage.
As like a way to get protein. All those protein powders are 85% whey or more.
There's now a shortage of curds.
Yeah. Well, now we're just making cheese in order to produce whey.
That's why all that government cheese is piling up.
But so cheese curds were kind of they were throughout the Midwest and in Canada, all the cow growing country. It was a working class snack. Right, if you had access to the makings of cheese enough that you could grab a bunch of these little sort of fingertip-sized cheese blobs.
How come they're bigger than cottage cheese curds? Because they're a good size. They're a good snack size.
Yeah, it's different kinds of cheese enzymes produce different sized curds, and you know, most.
So nobody ever has to crumble it up. Those just appear that way.
Yeah. Most curdles, if you let milk curdle in the fridge, you see that they're much smaller little pebbles.
But I didn't put rennet in, probably.
Yeah, and cheese curds are a product of cheddar cheese making, really. You know, there's...
Oh, is that right?
Yeah, there are lots of
different... It's true, they always look and taste like cheddar.
Yeah, they're basically proto-cheddar.
Could we not have, like, Swiss cheese curd?
Would well, kill the curds would be a lot different size. Like a mozzarella stick. Mozzarella sticks also were really only recently developed. All those stringy cheese. Mm. If you pull cheese so that the fibers line up...
It's a very big if.
Well, but it's a traditional food in like the Czech Republic and all these different cultures have stringy cheese. But string mozzarella is a...
It was not invented until the late 80s.
Yeah, or like invented in the late 70s and then became popularized in the 80s and then somebody dropped it in a deep fryer.
It's a funner name for... Yeah, and then TGI Friday started.
Yeah, exactly. A guy named Frank Baker invented string mozzarella
sticks.
Yeah, and then somebody threw it in a deep fryer, and they were like, this is even better. It's going to put Chili's on the map.
Was it Chili's? I'm trying to remember.
Whoever, where was the first mozzarella?
Where did I get mozzarella sticks?
I had Applebee's? My first one at Red Robin.
Ah, there we go.
That's where I had nachos, I think, for the first time.
What an amazing idea. I bet if we deep fried this, people, wow.
Yeah.
You really, Red Robin is really your Epcot-like tour of the world.
Well, I worked at Red Robin. I was the Red Robin.
Wait, somebody there is a Red Robin?
Yeah, I was a busboy, but then they realized that I fit the costume.
Wait, every Red Robin has a costume?
And so I would wear the costume, and I would go around to kids' birthday parties, and they said, you're so good at this, we're going to take you to the children's hospital. And so I would go to the children's hospital ward, and I would walk up and down in my Red Robin costume and go, you know, like...
Were you allowed to talk?
No, didn't talk.
It's made Robin noises?
And then I went, you know, like miming. It's something that you do with... it's its own set of skills.
I've never been to a restaurant that had a fursuit. And I've been to Red Robin and didn't know there was probably still one hanging in the back somewhere.
Well, you know, this was in Anchorage, and I think we only had one Red Robins in Anchorage at the time. And so maybe this was the Alaska fursuit.
Is this why you moved here to the home of the birthplace of Red Robin?
Like, and my dad, you know, my dad used to go to the Red Robin when it was a brand new, when it was a tavern.
The flagship one.
Yeah. And I don't think there was a guy in a costume at that either. But then they started taking me to the state fair. Every time 15 people gathered in the road, I would show up. And we couldn't once I had it on, we couldn't travel in any kind of car, so I had to ride around in the back of a pickup truck.
You couldn't sit down?
No, it's a giant costume.
You're saying this like I can picture it.
Well, it's me, already too big for a car, and then you put like a huge Red Robin costume on me. So I would drive around Anchorage in the back of a pickup truck, waving at cars like, hey, everybody, except without talking.
The problem is that DC now has a Batman sidekick called Red Robin, which makes it very hard to find the Red Robin restaurant costume.
That's lame.
If any pictures indeed exist.
Anyway, this being a traditional food of sort of mid North America cow culture working class people.
Oh, I found it. Is it a big head?
Yeah, it's a big head, but a full costume, like bird legs
but
and
But the rest
bird.
Of the costume is kind of form-fitting. It's the head that seems unwieldy.
Well, at the time, that wasn't true. At the time, the bottom half of it, it had suspenders, and then a big tail, and the top half of it was like wearing a barrel, and then bird wings.
You had wings.
I had wings. So they've obviously simplified the Red Robin costume since the 80s.
All right. Well, now I will never picture you without this outfit again.
Thank you.
Maybe the mask and nothing else.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/kidsandfamily. Just go to Indeed.com/kidsandfamily right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring, Indeed, is all you need.
When you think of the cuisine du Canada,
mm-hmm.
what springs to mind?
So I didn't actually know Canada had a cuisine until maybe the first time I went there. Like, I didn't even think there were, I didn't even know there were stereotypes.
You're not 100% wrong, or even 50% wrong. But when you think of, like, the food of Canada.
Now that I know a little more, I know they call elephant ears beaver tails.
Okay, that's a kind of donut.
And they put, yeah, it's like a big fried,
yeah,
a fried flatbread thing, right, like a funnel cake maybe, mm-hmm, adjacent.
Very close to that, a little powdered sugar.
And I know about the maple syrup being more essential to their palate than here. So I guess I'm imagining them eating a lot of wheat cakes.
Yeah. Pancakes, basically.
Yeah, but they probably call them something weird, like wheat cakes, because they're not American.
Yeah, yeah. Could be. What you're describing is not really a cuisine. and this is part of the problem of Canadian cuisine.
Well, what would the American cuisine be?
Well, that's the thing. There are many, many American cuisines. And we have in America always been... it's part of our culture to identify regional cuisines as a regional cuisine.
True.
Cajun food, Boston baked beans, we actually put it right there in the name.
But you share them too. It's like when I go here, there's going to be a chowder place and there's going to be a jambalaya place and chili.
It goes all over, but you know, even chili or think about barbecue. There are 15 different kinds of barbecue and people fight, you know, like border wars over, oh, that's St. Louis barbecue. I'm not going to let that pass my lips.
But if you're in Europe, you can go to the American restaurant,
yeah,
which will be kind of this gross,
yeah, it'll
jukeboxy
have nachos,
diner, gigantic milkshakes,
strawberry milk and whatnot.
Yeah. But kids love it.
Kids love it.
European kids are like, can we go to the American restaurant?
Yeah, but it's terrible. The hamburgers don't taste like hamburgers. The snozzberries don't taste like snozzberries.
All foods kids like are bad.
In Canada, there were regional cuisines, but mostly the food of Canada is just the food of Europe, slightly modified by different ingredients. There are all the pot pies, and there are all the, like, you know.
What do Europeans eat? Dumplings?
A deluxe Canadian breakfast. Sausages? Is just a deluxe English breakfast with one or two different kinds of ham.
I guess Canadian bacon I was aware of as a kid, but they don't, of course.
It's just ham.
They just call it.
Just yeah. A different part of the pig.
What do they call it? Back bacon?
They do. Yeah, or that's maybe a different kind. There's so many bacons. It's hard to keep it all straight. And a lot of the food in Canada is, you know, is just what you would eat if you were an indigenous person. It's like game, fish, clams, deer, cooked in a European butter.
They're sticking with that.
And then, of course, maple syrup being famous. But there's not the same kind of like, oh, it's...
America equals hamburgers,
Louisiana,
hot dogs.
And then Tex-Mex food and so forth.
Is it because there's not enough people for them to have BC cuisine and Prairie Province cuisine and...
Well, like we talked about last episode, I think the British colony, the persistence of Canada as a British colony...
The persistence of Canada.
...meant that... That English cuisine persisted as a governing principle, right? The thing that united Canada,
scones,
was being united from outside rather than America, which was like, well, we're uniting ourselves, but we're maintaining our regionality. Hmm. The one exception being Quebec and the Maritime Provinces, right? I mean, if you think about the difference between Ontario and Winnipeg, can you give me one difference between, from your perspective as an American?
Income?
Yeah. But like culturally?
Yeah, no.
Yeah, Saskatchewan, Winnipeg.
I don't really have a sense. There's probably some.
I know Winnipeg is not a province, but.
I mean, because I know cities in Ontario, for example, I think of it as kind of a red state, blue state divide. You know, I'm imagining I'm imagining a very Chicago-like Toronto.
Yeah, 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 right.
Whereas the Prairie Provinces, you know, feel more like Texas to me.
Except, well, ooh, not Texas, but yeah,
They've got the Petro and the cattle.
They do, but they're culturally, I guess, more similar to, North Dakota, a place you've never been.
Correct.
But it was not until, and this is the crazy thing about a lot of these food trends, is that they don't really arrive until the mid-century.
The mid-20th century.
The mid-20th century, yeah.
That's when Canada gets food?
Well, that's basically when Canada just stops, when Canadians stop chewing on bark and they enter the world. And like so many wonderful foods, our story and poutine starts as a working class diner creation, which is maybe not that hard to imagine if you know what poutine is.
I didn't have poutine until, I don't know, 2007?
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Poutine is a very recent addition to the global menu. And what poutine is, to those of you who have never had it, although I think that number is increasingly shrinking as poutine becomes widely available, poutine is French fries or Belgian fries, however you like to call them, fried potatoes, patatas fritas.
I can't believe you're doing a show on potatoes.
Well, I'm mostly against poutine for that reason, although, as we'll see right at the end, there are now increasingly, poutine has become a more diverse
set of ingredients. There are options for the potato skeptical gentleman.
But the traditional poutine is French fried potatoes, covered with cheese curds, then covered with brown gravy.
So we all like cheese fries. That seems like an easy sell. But I feel like it would not be intuitive for an American to be like, and then I'm going to pour brown gravy over it. That seems like an ancestor of your, that seems to come from your British cuisine.
It does require that you have an abundance of gravy. You know, when I'm making food and I want a gravy, I make gravy, but there's never enough gravy. Is this true of your Thanksgivings? Is there never enough gravy?
Yeah, there's that joke in The Odd Couple about how Oscar thinks gravy comes when you cook the meat. And, and he's shocked that, you know, in fact, that you don't get enough drippings to really make a lot of gravy. Somebody would have to sit with a package of powdered gravy if you want to supplement your gravy needs.
Well, you can make gravy with butter.
Yes.
A brown sauce is what it is. I mean, it is still a gravy.
I mean, to me, gravy has to come from the meat,
the drippings,
right?
Yeah. And in order to make enough gravy that you're like, oh, what are we going to do with all this gravy? Why don't we pour it on the French fries? You would have to be cooking a lot of meat.
Where do they, are they making just, is it just like gravy from a pouch? Are they making astronaut gravy?
No. So we're talking about in the 1950s.
There's no instant gravy.
There are diners, you know, Quebec is not like a wealthy province at this time, and rural Quebec, not a wealthy area. There are a lot of working class diners that have a kind of distinctive, it's just diner food like it is anywhere in the United States. There's French fries, there's other food associated with French fries. But the difference being that there are cheese curds because these diners are located in curd-making country. And as we've said, you can't have curds. Curds that don't squeak are barely curds at all. And in order to have squeaky curds, you have to be right there with the milk.
Do you think the curds are an ingredient, or are they just serving them as a finger food?
Curds are finger food, and yeah, they're not. They don't keep curds around to sprinkle on chef salads. I think curds are, and of course, deep fried curds are a version of curds that in some parts of Canada now, if you say cheese curds, you mean deep fried cheese curds, yeah. And in order to differentiate your fresh curds, you would have to say fresh curds, squeaky curds.
I can't remember what Culver's calls there. Do they just say cheese curds? I think they just call their deep fried side cheese curds.
Cheese curds, yeah. And that's the thing. It's become a deep fried curds predate cheese sticks in the U.S., but it's effectively like maybe a better cheese stick, or at least a non-mozzarella cheese stick.
Less healthy cheese stick.
Yeah, that's the problem with poutine. It's not heart smart. But in the Centre de Québec region of Quebec, which is the part that's nowhere near the center of the province of Quebec, but it's the part down close to the United States, there arose out of the diner culture there this meal, which was essentially and originally called fromage patate sauce. The three ingredients, fromage, patates, and sauce.
The sauce just being the gravy they would serve on the biscuits or whatever.
Yeah. And there are two diners, like in all these foods that rise up, like Cincinnati chili, there are a few claimants to the origin story.
And they're fighting over being the birthplace of poutine?
Yeah. One of them is a man by the name of Ferdinand Lachance, who had a cafe called Le Café Ideal.
The Ideal Cafe.
The Ideal Cafe. They actually had poutine on the menu as early as 1957, but it was not clear. This was in Warwick, a town, small town there. It was not codified as fromage patate sauce. And in fact, that development and that coinage came from a nearby town, Drummondville, and a restaurateur by the name of Jean-Paul Roy, who...
Probably Roy. Jean-Paul Roy.
Although it's R-O-Y, not R-O-I.
I think that's how Patrick Roy spelled it.
And his restaurant was called Le Roy Giuseppe. And I think the foodies, the food scientists, the food historians have, I think, credited him with the real popularization of the food.
Ah, and then they're going to put him on the money someday.
The etymology of the word poutine is, again, there's 700 different...
Oh, really?
Yeah, people are like, well, it could be this, it could be that.
It's so recent and nobody knows where the word comes from.
Because poutine sounds kind of like pudding.
Ooh.
And pudding being a very Canadian food.
British-oriented.
Straight from Britain.
Yeah.
But also there are several different sort of francophone words. Like, for instance, pontingo.
What?
Is pontingo. It means bad stew.
Bad stew?
Bad stew.
We don't have a single word for bad stew in English.
Well, no, I guess we don't.
We would have to say bad stew.
The thing about bad stew is you want to throw that out, right?
Yeah, you don't want to think of a new word for it.
I mean, you've eaten stew at my house. Was it a...
No, it was a good stew.
It was a good stew.
But then we don't have a word for good stew either.
I think all stew is good. I have made bad stews, and I haven't thrown them out. I've just eaten them because I'm a sufferer.
You were silently stewing.
I was. There's also the word poutit, which means a hodgepodge.
Well, that's promising.
Yep. But, you know, everybody wants it to be a certain thing. And I think within
Canada...
But it's
not poutin, like the...
Poutin.
The insult word.
Oh, I don't think.
Okay.
No. But so cheese curds kind of percolated as a regional and, you know, lower class food in southern Quebec.
In like, where are we, the 50s?
We're in the 50s through the 60s. And then there was a food truck that was...
I didn't know poutine was like basically brought to the world in my lifetime.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. I
assume Canadians have been happily eating poutine for decades and they just hadn't told us.
No, it was a thing that... At the time, throughout the 70s and 80s, and you probably remember this all the way into the 2000s, it was a little bit of a food slur, like something that was ridiculous about Canada.
Yeah.
And in particular, ridiculous about Quebec. So here in the United States, we thought of poutine as an example of how unsophisticated Canada was.
Well, this is their national food.
Yeah, oh my God, can you believe this? Potato with gravy and cheese. But within Canada... It was similarly a kind of slur against Quebec, like typical, you know, these people over here with their cheese and their gravy. What kind of madness is this? Cheese curds already being sort of a roadside snack.
Yeah.
Like pull into the place, got a big sign out front, curds.
It's like the equivalent of putting like potato chips on your fancy casserole.
Yeah. And it became kind of a city thing in the 80s or in the 70s, I guess, but definitely a food truck kind of food that was being introduced into urban Canada as like, get a load of this, like, you know, sort
it's
of
like carnival food.
All food in Portland is sort of based on a truck where somebody is like, get a load of this. Like, I took some fish and I put potato chips on it and then I swung it in the air.
It's bulgogi, but it's in a taco now.
Exactly. Yeah. And it wasn't until, I don't think that poutine entered the lexicon, even in Canada, until the 80s. In 1983, it was first served
to the Prime Minister.
It first went on the menu at Burger King in Canada.
Interesting.
In 83. And so that gives you a sense of it being a kind of trash food.
Yeah.
You know, even up there. Well, I mean, I guess it wasn't down here yet. And in the 90s, it went through a kind of reappropriation where poutine, which had been this sort of, you know, working class food that no one would dignify, became a kind of place for young chefs and cool kid restaurants to fusion, you know, to like to make with fancy ingredients.
I remember in the 2000s here, there was this trend of everybody, you know, all restaurants would have some comfort food, but really gussied up. Like, you've had a corn dog, but what if it had lobster in it?
Or, exactly.
You know, that kind of trend.
There was a poutine that had foie gras on it, and everybody was like, ha, 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 and it's so good.
Well, I mean, the thing about, you can't deny that poutine is pretty good, because there's nothing wrong with, unless you're John Rogers,
I don't like potatoes.
Fried potatoes, cheddar cheese, and gravy. Nobody dislikes those three things.
Right, except me.
Except you.
You know, my introduction to cheese curds and to poutine came in the, well, the early 2000s as part of being on tour. And the first time I remember being in the you know, the prairie states.
So you first had it in Canada.
Well, it would have been either, I think it probably was in Wisconsin, where we first saw cheese curds. And that really, there really are places where you're driving through Wisconsin and there's just somebody in a fireworks stand on the side of the road like, curds! And we pulled over and we're like, what
you
the
squeal?
Hell?
Squeal yeah. Over.
And the,
did you say curds?
They hand you this bag of very, very salty little cheese nuggets. And so we were immediately fans, but then we toured Canada a lot, and poutine had started to disseminate.
Every bar.
So that we, cafe. You know, we couldn't avoid it. And then the other guys loving potatoes, I started to have poutine around me all the time. And of course—
Was it enough gravy and cheese on it that you could eat it, or yes. Were you still like, nah?
I will eat anything with gravy on it. And if you have gravy and cheese, I really can't resist.
That sounds like a dare. I will eat anything— Like you're at a sideshow. It's come see the man who will eat anything if it has gravy on it. He'll eat a skyscraper I-beam.
It's sort of not untrue. If you put gravy on a thing, a lot of my resistance to eating it just sort of goes away.
Here's John eating a bonsai tree.
I mean, the premise being that you put gravy on things that call for gravy. I mean, if you put gravy on a beet, I'd be like, well, I guess I'll try it. But
you're not excited.
I'm not like, yay, another way to eat beets. Although beets are great, but so poutine was like a snack food at hockey games, you know, it had entered the culture, but it was still identified as a Quebec food, and it was a novelty food, like you say, and it had analogs. I mean, in New Jersey. They had popularized something called disco fries, which were the same. It was fries, but covered with mozzarella cheese and gravy.
Oh, but it did have the gravy.
It had gravy.
I feel like cheese fries kind of probably predate poutine in the U.S.
Cheese fries are, well, and the thing is that the way that poutine evolved is that you had fries and somebody was like, I'd like a side of cheese curds, and then you throw the squeaky curds on top of the hot fries, and then it's like, oh, this is pretty good. And then fries with gravy had long been a thing. So
really?
Fries with gravy.
I mean, even in Europe, you get fries with gravy.
I don't love it. I mean, fries are supposed to have that crispness. You don't want to soak them in anything before you eat them.
Well, and that's the wonderful thing. That's what makes working class food so darn good is it's very... You're right there where the food is getting made, so it's very fresh. I mean, my first deluxe English breakfast was served to me in a canal-side like stevedore shack, and it was the greatest thing I ever saw. And then I
could have been eating baked beans at 9 a.m. my whole life.
Baked beans poured on top of soggy tomatoes with four kinds of sausage? What have I been doing? But then, you know, increasingly I would see it occur on, you know, pop up on menus in fancy restaurants. And it's always like, well, this is kind of precious compared to what, you know, my first exposure to it, which was like glorp.
Yep.
But great. And again, the necessity that the curds be that particular consistency kept it regional, I think, a long time past. I mean, the poutine you got at Burger King probably didn't squeak.
It's probably shredded cheddar, honestly, yeah. Right?
I mean, well, in Canada, it still needed to be a curd. It's just that once you heat up a curd, it kind of...
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Yeah. Melted cheese is melted cheese.
Yeah. But then poutine started to...
metastasize.
It did. It was not until...
It became airborne.
It became an airborne virus,
that's right?
Poutine, it wasn't until the mid-2000s, and this is right when we were encountering it as a band, and it was still very much presented as like, get a load of this mess. It kind of went through a cultural transformation where it was in Canada no longer being mocked as a joke food by the, you know, a joke food that was kind of an analog or analogous to how backwards Quebecers were, to increasingly being a source of pride.
I assume that's a result of outsiders, mostly Americans, mistaking poutine for a national symbol.
Yeah.
And so, hey, if poutine's going to be as closely associated with Alberta as it is with Quebec, then we're not going to, you know, we can't put it down. We can't scorn it.
Right. And it's also pretty good.
Yeah.
And, you know, I mean, what Americans think of Canadian cuisine as back bacon, pancake syrup, and Tim Hortons donut holes.
Right. I forgot about Timbits.
Yeah. And those are just Americans that have been to Canada. Americans that haven't been to Canada, I don't think, well, could even tell you anything about Canada.
I assume they eat normal food like we do.
But so there became, within Canada, a sort of poutine pride that, and I think a component of that was the fancification of poutine. And it, so it became a kind of catch-all for a mess plate, you know, like not a garbage plate.
But you could put other ingredients on it.
Well, and people started substituting. And there are, you know, Canada is full of immigrant populations. You know, people from all around the world have emigrated to Canada and formed kind of the nucleus of an expatriate community of Poles or an expatriate community of Ethiopians or whatnot. Yeah. And as poutine went through these different cultures, different ingredients would be substituted in and out. It's like, well, now this is poutine, but with curry, or this is poutine, except without, we don't eat potatoes, so it's pierogi covered with cheese curds, covered with gravy. Or, you know, and you've got cooks in there too who are like, ha ha ha, we're going to experiment with lobster and poutine.
The first time I ever ate it, I think, was actually, it was kind of the upscale thing in a kind of a fancified Seattle diner.
Yeah.
It was actually Josh Henderson's Skillet food truck, I think, which then became a brick and mortar place, and which you can now get at SeaTac.
Yeah. They took away Pizza Haven in the Seattle center, which I'll never forgive. But that, no, Pizza Haven had already gone away.
I think Pizza Haven might have been gone. And it wasn't that good.
Pizza Haven was amazing. Don't you dare slur Pizza Haven. You know, it was a Shoreline restaurant.
Is that true?
Yeah. Pizza Haven was up at Aurora Village.
That was the original Haven?
Well, that was the one I knew.
So, they would have fries with their burgers, but their fancy thing was, you know, you could pay extra and get poutine. And it was exotic food, you know? It was like, you've never had this. But it wasn't cheap working man's food.
No, that's right.
Because nothing was at that kind of place.
No, it was fancy. And by 2000, poutine had become a thing throughout Canada, I guess, that there was a prankster television show that interviewed a bunch of different political candidates, like American political candidates. Mm-hmm. And one of their gags was, how are you going to, what's your relationship going to be with Canadian Prime Minister Jean Poutine? And they got a lot of, including George W. Bush, responses from people like, I will work with President Poutine. And then, you know, and then it was the source of like, but even then, that's kind of using poutine in a déclassé sort of way.
This is reminding me that Canada kind of came by all its nationally uniting signifiers surprisingly late. Like, do you know when the maple leaf became the flag of Canada?
No.
It's like 1965.
Really?
Yeah. Like, Kennedy is dead. Like, John F. Kennedy never could have predicted that Canada would have a maple leaf on its flag.
Was it just the Hudson Bay Company flag before that? It has a beaver and a moose.
It was just a beaver pelt on a pole. Do you know when O Canada became the national anthem?
When?
1980.
Phenomenal.
Jimmy Carter, I think, got it done.
Well, what happened with poutine is that it was still, even into the 2010s, very, very much a folksy food. And I think it is still a folksy food.
It's country food.
There are poutine festivals. There's a poutine festival that's actually a traveling festival that goes through the whole summer.
Well, I wish they would come here.
There are some... You know, they're competing poutine festivals. Le Grand Poutine Fest, yeah, is it like goes from town to town, and everyone comes out and celebrates poutine for a week. And just in the last 5 years, it has morphed into like. Like winning hockey teams now will actually eat poutine out of the Stanley Cup itself. Like,
As if poutine is as venerable a symbol of Canada as the Cup.
As the Cup.
That's funny.
Although the Stanley Cup winners have all been American teams.
It's been a while.
Recently.
It's been a while.
The players are from Canada. And so,
of course.
You know, they
and
celebrate.
And the Cup still miraculously produces poutine.
Yep.
Like the Finnish Sampo.
It's a fountain of poutine.
Correct.
But poutine has, as you predicted, become increasingly a symbol of Canada, and partly it's because it's asserting itself as a new food type, like soup or sandwich. There's also now...
That's just it's like a bed of rice you could put anything on?
Yeah, it's like...
Or a tortilla you could put
poutine,
anything on?
Poutine, it's like a stir fry or a... Or, yeah, a rice bowl.
And what do they have to have?
A wrap.
Apparently, they don't have to have the potatoes, if you can substitute pierogi.
It does feel like the defining characteristic of it is any three things.
Like, if you just mix together three things in a bowl, a Canadian will think it's poutine.
I mean, almost every food I eat kind of qualifies as a poutine. It's not a stew because it's not like in a sauce. There's a sauce on it.
It seems like they're using it the way we use casserole, some kind of hot, mixed up, possibly starchy thing.
Yeah, but it's not put together and then baked. It's like a hot fried thing that's crispy, a soft, milky thing that's squeaky, and a saucy thing that's salty.
It's all three food groups.
And it's like
crispy, squeaky, and salty. Saucy. Yeah.
Right, which is also, I mean, all three of them are full of fat.
And good for you.
Right? Like, it's basically a greasy thing.
Yeah, there's no actually healthy ingredient in poutine, now that I think about it.
No, not at all. And I don't
Those
know...
Those are all sometimes foods.
It doesn't sound, from any of the fancy versions of it I've read about, none of them sound very healthy. It's always putting something even worse for you, like duck liver or something on it.
But nobody's like, what if you use arugula instead of fries?
I bet you there are. I bet you can go into a vegan restaurant in Canada and get a poutine made out of all vegetables,
delicious sources, soy foods.
Because I bet you, yeah. I mean, you can make a squeaky soy. I've had a
Vegetarians kind of, like nothing more than eating curds. out of things that we had never before curded.
That's right. Well, and that's why we didn't want to call them curds because of that association.
Because you.
But vegetarians are like, more curds. Curd it up, yo.
Yeah, they're always saying that.
But culturally now, that has become a problem within Canada because as poutine has become the national food of Canada, it is effectively another form of Quebec erasure.
I see. They've lost their potent cultural symbol. It's like how, it's like the difference between Parmesan cheese from the Parma region and other hard cheeses.
So, and there is somewhat of a, you know, I think within Quebec, a sort of sense of like, well, New Orleans food is still called New Orleans food. Gumbo is not thought of as American food. Mm. And even though barbecue is, there are 17 kinds of barbecue that, you know, that will instigate a fist fight. Like, we do have regionalisms that retain their regionalism.
And there's a very active separatist movement that does not apply right now to every kind of regional barbecue or jambalaya.
That's right.
And in America.
And so within Quebec, there is a sense of a grievement.
Okay.
That this was an opportunity for if we're going to make this the national food of Canada, let's put a little fleur-de-lis flag on the top of it. And that's not what's happening. It's becoming the hamburger of Canada.
But that's what happens when your good ideas win, you know, like your band becomes big and moves to the major label. Sorry, poutine. Sorry, Quebec. And that concludes Poutine, entry 973.PS10709, certificate number 30037, in the Omnibus. Find Omnibus, a product of its time, archived at Omnibus Project on various no longer extant social media platforms, which were all a mistake. Email us at theomnibusproject@gmail.com with your worst regional poutine stories. Send us poutine. Don't send us poutine. Mm. But send us what? Send us cheese curd? No, also not shelf stable.
Nope.
Send us little fleur-de-lis toothpick flags.
Yeah, we can put on club sandwiches. We love little tchotchkes from mid-century Canada. I have lots of throw pillows that have like the little blazons of the different provinces of Canada. I have like three of those. The coat of arms of the different provinces.
Send your Canadiana to Omnibus Project, P.O. Box 55744, Shoreline, Washington, 98155. Or I'll come and pick it up because I got the LexisNexis card.
And sounds like you've got some mail over there, too.
Yeah, and I think I know what this is. I have a guess.
Why? Because it's in a bag and that I'm says right. Cheese curds?
No, our friend, our listener, Zach, has sent us... He works at the Library of Congress as the publisher of their in-house publishing office.
Cool.
Which has lately, like a lot of other imprints, gotten the business of printing cool out-of-print stuff.
Cool.
I don't know about you, but I rather than reading the Book of the Summer, I would much rather rediscover some 1920s Icelandic novel.
And
a lot of publishers have really tapped into this insufferable hipster tendency. And he sent us in the past a couple Library of Congress mystery collections, because they have this crime classics line, one was a kind of an Afro-Caribbean kind of voodoo-themed thing. And what was the other one? I don't know. I have them on my shelf in the San Juan Islands where I take all short stories.
This is fattening up your library.
It's great because when I go up to the San Juans, I don't want to like pick up the novel I was reading a month ago.
Right.
So that house is all short stories.
Yeah, right. You're sitting on the potty and you'd like a little...
And I want Alice Munro when I'm sitting on the potty. Mm-hmm. Sorry, Canada. Also, sorry about Alice Munro's second husband. But we mentioned in the Brushy Mountain Prison Breakout entry, I talked about a favorite mystery story I read as a kid about a jailbreak.
Yeah.
And
jailbreak.
It's by Jacques Futrelle, who died in the Titanic. And Zach emailed to say, hey, we put those back in print.
Nice.
And sure enough, here's a copy of classic stories about the thinking machine, and it leads off with the problem of cell 13, which is the one I liked as a kid, because I think Scholastic had the rights to it. And what? Six other stories. So check out the Library of Congress Crime Classics line, which I really enjoy. Thank you, Zach. Oh, he also sent us this. This is something else he sent us. American Feast. It's a... it's kind of a coffee table book of recipe and recipe-related art from period cookbooks and, you know, supermarket cocktail index cards and whatnot.
When you say sent us, of course, you mean sent you.
I mean, it's been in this room. If he sent two, you, now we each have it. If he sent one and I didn't want it, you have it. Who can say who kept American Feast? I think you should have American Feast. If I have it, I'm going to return it. So thank you, Zach. Once again, P.O. Box 55744, Shoreline, Washington. Unclear zip code, UZC. Might be 98155, might be 98133. Or average amount, 98144. See if it gets to us.
I wonder.
Why not? You could find other futurelings online. In the early 21st century on Facebook and Reddit, just look for futurelings, and then you'll find other people to complain about.
Mm-hmm.
Other Canadians will be angry at us after either last week's show or this one.
Correct.
And finally, we need your Canadian or U.S. currency to support the show.
Send us that suitcase full of Canadian toonies.
If you're in a Montreal cafe and you find a ton of money, or if Ben Gibbard is trying to pass off his drug earnings.
That's what it is.
Pocket some of those hundreds and send them to patreon.com/omnibusproject. You think these insufferable dynamic ads for Thursday people are paying the bills around here? They are not. We are still almost entirely listener supported.
Yes.
The ad money's nice. The ad money lines our pockets and our Sacramento bank teller's pockets.
Indeedly do.
We do like a sustainable podcast, but most of our ability to keep paying the bills and keeping the lights on around here comes from you, the listener. If you have been a Thursday listener for years and you want the good feeling of accomplishment and insider status that comes with being a Tuesday person, go to patreon.com/omnibusproject.
You know, the funny thing about poutine in just recent years is that...
Poutine PS.
Poutine PS is that the pronunciation of poutine and the last name of the Soviet dictator...
There now is a president,
Vladimir Putin.
And it's not the fake one they tricked George W. Bush with.
It's the same exact pronunciation. And so prior to the invasion of Ukraine...
Mm-hmm.
It was the source of a lot of, like in Seattle, all Thai restaurants have a pun in their name.
Taiwan on. Pho Q.
Right. And then, and pho restaurants too. It's a very pun-based restaurant naming system here in the Northwest. And poutine as a menu item, and there now are restaurants specializing in 50 kinds of poutine, and they often had Vladimir Putin puns in their restaurant name.
And now it's not funny.
And it became not funny, so much so that that Roi Giuseppe changed the name of poutine on his trend-setting restaurant's menu.
This is the original one.
The original one, back to fromage patates sauce.
Wow.
As a Ukraine support thing. And then a lot of restaurants are changing the name of poutine basically in a freedom fries sort of situation.
Literally.
They're not French fries anymore. They're called freedom fries.
Is it called Zelensky with an OU? Zelensky?
Zelensky? It's like now I think maybe people are. I don't think they're going back to poutine puns. They might not be calling them.
I did notice a trend of people fries. Changing, you know, the. Russian whatever on their menu to now it's Ukrainian dumplings or
yeah.
I'll order a Ukrainian mule. And I was like, come on, this is freedom fries crap.
It's pretty funny, but it is also our times. I mean, basically all of it is disidentification stigmatization and reappropriation, Ken. That's pretty much, well, and that's basically what Omnibus does. Just chew it up, spit it back out.
What is it? Do you, something stigmatization and...
So poutine was stigmatized.
Yes.
Then people disidentified with it as, you know, I don't want anything to do with your comical poutine. And then it became reappropriated as a... And I think now there are...
That's the cycle of life.
Quebec separatists who are like, no, poutine belongs to us. And you can screw off with your Canada-wide poutine.
They're going to start blowing up bridges with poutine-based plastic explosives.
But I think now that it has become a food type, it's a new goulash.
Yeah, that's you can't close the door.
You can't put the poutine back in the bastic.
It's done.
Futurelings, from our vantage point in your distant past, we have no idea how long our civilization survived. We hope and pray that the catastrophe we fear may never come. But if the worst comes soon, this recording, like all our recordings, may have been our final word. But if Providence allows, we wish you many goods and cheese curds.
Goods, curds, and cheese curds.
And hope to be back with you soon for another entry in the Omnibus.